Good evening or good morning, just depending on when you're listening to this podcast. But this is Bill and Bryant's Dude, Where's My Movie? My name is Bryant Daniels, and with me is my co-host, Mr., and I'll let him introduce himself,
Bill Nelson.
Yes, sir. So this is our first recording, correct?
No.
Oh, yeah. Technically, this is our second recording. Thank you for calling me on that. Our first recording was just a test run, but we will be posting this one directly to iTunes to discuss our favorite subject matter. And obviously, if you've downloaded this podcast, it is also your favorite subject matter. Right now, you will know that we are working off a $10 microphone connected to a computer from Fry's Electronics. Go Fry's. I know we're not getting paid to support them, but I do love Fry's. Although I would much rather shop for my films at places like Entertain Mart in Dallas off of Preston Road or at the Movie Trading Company. Usually you get much better deals, the movies are used, and you're okay. What we're going to do now, since this is our very first podcast, we are going to introduce ourselves. I'm going to start with Bill. What we're going to tell you is our first names. I'm going to give you my last name. Bill's already given you his last name, so I guess that point is moot. But we're going to tell you a little bit of what we like, a little bit of what we enjoy. And so you, as the listener, will have an idea of whether or not you will continue to listen. Although, Bill, I don't know if anybody will continue to listen to us after this.
Well, we'll certainly do our best to garrote them into listening.
I'm okay with this. I'm going to go around and force people to listen. As you know, my brother is coming into town tomorrow. I'm going to give him a copy of this podcast, and I will force him to listen to it on his trip to Africa. After all, what else does he have to do? So, Bill, tell us a little bit about yourself. Me and you have come to know each other over the past couple of months from work. We will not reveal who we work for because the opinions on this radio program / podcast are not supported by any type of employer. So, Bill, cinema, movies, the wonderful drink which you're pouring. What brings you to love, and what was your first experience with the cinema?
Okay. Well, as most of you don't know, because we haven't ever told you before, I've got a good 7 years on Bryant here.
This is true.
So I'm the fogey.
This is true.
My very first movie, the first movie I ever remember seeing in the cinema, in the theater, the first movie my parents ever took me to.
Okay.
Return of the Jedi.
Classic. My personal favorite Star Wars film. A lot of people argue Empire.
Empire.
I stick with Return. I'm sorry, the Ewoks are amazing.
They should have been Wookiees.
I love Ewoks. So what kind of cinema are you interested in at this point in your life?
I hesitate to say stereotypical, because I'm not stereotypical, but I am your pop culture junkie.
Okay. A modern pop culture, prior pop culture, historic pop culture. You'll have to excuse us both. We're both a little bit tipsy.
As we will always be during these podcasts.
Yes, because it's just the best way to record, darn it.
Well, there's no better radio than drunk radio.
The polar bear on the side of your Coca-Cola is looking quite fine. I'd do her. Did I just admit to bestiality?
You did.
Let's cut that one out.
We don't condone unnatural acts on this show.
That is true. We do not.
That being said, it's your definition of an unnatural act that we don't condone.
Yes, sir. Anybody can consider the Aqua Teen Hunger Force movie an unnatural act, Personally, I was stoned when I saw it and thought it was the funniest thing I'd ever seen.
Well, there's nothing funnier than a good Aqua Teen Hunger Force episode.
Yes, but the problem is that 12-minute episode into an hour-and-a-half movie doesn't always work. Anyway, so let's move on.
Okay.
What are you interested in now?
You asked what type of pop culture.
Yes.
There is no type. Pop culture is pop culture.
Agreed.
So it's anything that doesn't fit into a clearly defined genre.
Okay.
But yet at the same time references the era in which it was made to an extent that it can no longer be considered conventional.
Okay.
In my opinion.
Okay.
The most recent example would be Scott Pilgrim.
Scott Pilgrim versus the World, excellent movie from Mr. Edgar Wright, who also did Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz.
And was the driving force, along with Simon Pegg, behind
Spaced, which are all three, in my opinion, considered classic adventures into the nature of comedy. Because Hot Fuzz is almost a parody of The Wicker Man, which is a classic to me.
But oh, yeah.
Still hilarious.
And yet it's also a very savvy spoof of the buddy cop genre.
True. It does a perfect thing. Okay. So, that is your interest. That is what you like. Is there anything right now that you wish you would have seen?
New movies, the one that I hurt the most for not having seen, is probably a toss-up between Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol.
I also want to see that.
And Sherlock Holmes, and I always forget the subtitle, so I'm just going to call it Sherlock Holmes Game of Thrones.
I'm sure we're getting two things confused there, but it's okay. I have not seen either one of those, and Sherlock Holmes itself, I didn't like the first one.
I thoroughly enjoyed the first one. I thought it was funny, thought-provoking, and surprisingly clever as far as a whodunit goes. Even though you knew who the bad guy was from the beginning, it was...
The one thing I will tell you about the new one, Game of Shadows, which I am interested in seeing, is that Moriarty is a character coming into this one. And I've always enjoyed him as Sherlock's quote-unquote arch-nemesis. Arch-nemesis? I'm sorry, I'm mixing two words. Arch-nemesis.
I'm suddenly picturing colostomy bags.
I just love the idea of an arch-enema. Alright, so let me tell you about just a little bit about myself. Okay, my name is Brian Daniels, as you have gotten in the introduction. My interests vary. Growing up, my first movie that I ever saw in theaters was The Great All Dogs Go to Heaven, which is a classic, classic cartoon. Sorry, it sticks with me. I don't care what anybody says. I love All Dogs.
Burt Reynolds and Dom DeLuise could not save that movie.
It was amazing. But my interest, as me and you have discussed, has peaked over time to different cinema. I love foreign. I love Japanese. So I would have to say that you have two different styles going on with this podcast.
He is... I'll put it this way. You love classic Japanese cinema.
I do love classic Japanese cinema.
I love modern.
I also love modern. But...
Ringu.
I loved Ringu.
Juon, which...
Juon?
That's
Korean.
Was it Korean?
It was Korean.
Was it?
It was Korean. It absolutely was. But the thing is that not only have I grown up to love foreign cinema, I've also grown up loving... And for lack of a better terminology, the Criterion Collection is what I could call it. Because it's those art house cinema features that are rarely used and rarely seen. I mean, some of my favorite movies of all time are The 400 Blows, The 39 Steps.
Classic Hitchcock.
Classic Hitchcock. The 47 Ronin, which has just become a recent favorite of mine. The Third Man. Casablanca, which is my number one movie of all time. But I'll also tell you this. The other thing I love with a great deal of pleasure is anything that is grindhouse cinema and exploitation cinema. Jackie Brown, The Monster Squad, Barbarella, and the most recent one, Hobo with a Shotgun. Do I love these movies as much as I love the classic cinema or the art house cinema? Absolutely. Absolutely, because they have something else to offer, as you will get. So here is what is the basic plot of, I call it a plot, of the podcast. We are going to be doing every week, this is as follows. We're going to confess to you what movies we've seen in the past week. We're going to go a little bit over those. We're going to do one review for you on a movie that either we've both seen, or we're going to do two reviews for you if we haven't come to cohorts with that. And then we're going to do a top five. To let you know, this week's top five is the top five loners in cinema history. So, Bill, are you excited?
I am drunk.
That is not what I asked you, sir.
But that's what I am.
Are you excited to do this podcast? Maybe. Okay. I think you are.
I think I might be.
I think you are extremely excited to do this podcast. All right, so we're going to go with the confession. You are making those very weird eyes at me, sir. It's making me all tingly down low.
I shall stop then.
Good. All right, so we're going to go into our confessions for the week as far as what we have seen. Now, you have explained to me earlier, what movies have you seen this week?
I have only watched one legitimate film.
Okay, and what is that?
I hesitate to say because most people would not consider it legitimate film.
I'm okay, I'm listening.
Conan the Barbarian, 2011.
Okay, so the remake of the Arnold Schwarzenegger classic, which was actually based off of a comic book.
It was based off of a series of novels written in the 30s and 40s.
Really? I have been schooled. I always assumed that it was based off the comic book. But then again, I am not a Conan collector. I'm not a collector of Conan.
Now, I couldn't tell you who wrote the books because I honestly haven't wikied it in a while.
Okay.
But, yes, Conan was created... My phone beeped.
That's okay. Keep going.
But my phone beeped.
It's okay. You're checking your phone.
Yes, my phone beeped.
And it is at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Nice. Okay, yes, Conan is based on a series of novels. There was a comic book.
I knew there was a comic book, and I knew there was an artist, a graphic artist attached to those comic books who made Conan's art relatively famous.
I honestly don't know much about the novels. I've seen the original Schwarzenegger film. Classic. Brutal, violent, surprisingly sad at times.
Absolutely, the original Schwarzenegger films. The R-rated Conan the Barbarian was much better than Conan the Destroyer.
Which, the only thing it had going for it was Arnold's muscles and Olivia Diabo being hot.
True.
So she still is today.
How did Conan the Barbarian 2011 rank up for you?
I found it to be a surprisingly fun popcorn flick.
Okay.
Not a lot of substance to it. It's not going to get a sequel.
Okay.
I can guarantee you that. If it does, may Arthur C. Clarke rot in hell. because he has nothing to do with it, but he's the first name I thought of.
Okay, that'll work.
But Jason Momoa, who came to fame playing the character of Ronan on the spin-off series Stargate Atlantis.
Yes.
Which is, if you've never watched the Stargate TV series, I highly recommend watching all three of them.
I have seen SG, SGU, and SGA.
SGU is, in my opinion, the best.
I absolutely agree.
But that's because it was also the darkest, and it explored the human condition a little more deeply.
I absolutely agree with you about SGU. Okay, so Ronan. Okay, you said it's a fun popcorn flick.
There's no real substance to the movie.
Okay.
It has a surprisingly coherent story.
Okay.
It has Ron Perlman in it, which is enough to sell me.
I love Ron Perlman.
Beyond that, I mean, it's basically Conan beating up people and fighting off magic spells from time to time.
I'm okay with that. It might be a good popcorn movie to watch.
Rose McGowan plays against type. She's normally known for playing the buxom vixen in any movie she's in.
Who does she play in this?
She's still buxom, but they do her best. They do their best, and to a certain extent, fail miserably, and yet at the same time, succeed horribly.
Okay.
In making her not attractive.
Really?
It's a really bad hairstyle. That's really all it is.
Well, I know that she will be in the upcoming remake of Red Sonja.
If they ever get it done, Robert Rodriguez keeps shuffling his feet on it.
Yeah.
She's also been attached at several times to play Barbarella in the remake of Barbarella.
Which I'm okay with.
And yet at the same time, I wish Hollywood would get an original idea and stop doing remakes and reboots.
Which brings me to my flickfession. My confession of movies that I have seen. Okay. So, my two movies, which I have seen in the past 2 weeks, or the past week, not 2 weeks, I saw a movie called After School. After School is from the year 2008. It stars the same individual who was in We Need to Talk About Kevin with Tilda Swinton, which I absolutely despised. I could not stand We Need to Talk About Kevin. It was one of those movies that just, I mean, overall it just gave me, not fear, but just left me with a sense of isolation from the actual subject matter itself. Now, Tilda Swinton in that movie was amazing, but we're not going to be talking about that.
She won an Oscar for that, didn't she?
I think she's nominated for an Oscar. What we're going to be talking about is After School. Okay, so After School, your basic story is we have an individual. Ezra Miller is the actor, who is a youth in today's society, who is, like every other youth, obsessed with YouTube and obsessed with reality programming. They want to see something real. So the filmmaker throughout the entire film is asking several questions, or at least I think he's asking several questions, about... Okay, so what happens when this YouTube generation becomes part of the reality? How do they deal with it? Do they deal with it through exploration of their feelings, or do they deal with it through explosion? Well, I will tell you something about After School. It had me. I loved it until the last 45 seconds. And the reason I hated it for the last 45 seconds is the filmmaker himself, who was 25 at the time, completely turned around and went for shock value. spoiler alert, if you haven't seen After School, it came out in 2008. I believe it's on Netflix Instant Streaming. What happens is that during the course of the film, while he is filming a couple of outside shots for scenery at school, what occurs is that he captures on film the reality of two of the girls in the school overdosing on drugs. He's become part of the reality. Well, the last 45 seconds, spoiler alert, shows that he actually ends up killing one of the girls. Completely lost me. Here you are asking some very intense, very deep questions about the nature of today's youth, and you could have left it at that. But what you end up doing is instead of leaving it at that, you go ahead and go for that shock value. Very disheartening. Extremely disheartening. I feel like you should have left it where it lied. That is just me, though, because I am also the same guy who loved Inception up until the last 12 seconds of the movie, and I think they should have ended the movie. And I understand where Nolan is coming from. I understand that during Following or during Memento, he never really wraps up the story, leaves it to the audience. While I felt Inception was a movie that you had been taken on a ride through so much and so far that you deserved a proper ending. You deserved a wrap-up to the story. Because I've heard of representation talking about doing a sequel to the movie, and I can't agree with that. I think they should have wrapped it up.
Nolan would never agree to a sequel.
No.
Quite frankly, I don't think Warner Brothers, even with their heft, could get it off the ground.
No, I don't believe so. Alright, so the second movie I saw, moving on, was Young and Innocent, which was from Sir Alfred Hitchcock. This was one of the movies that he did in the 1930s that often goes fell to be mentioned in the same category as The 39 Steps or The Man Who Knew Too Much. Young and Innocent was a movie that portrays a man who is accused of murder, who is trying to prove himself innocent, when we, as the audience, know that he is already innocent. Most people remember Hitchcock for his famous suspension roles. I will tell you this about Hitchcock. The one thing that I loved more about Hitchcock than the suspension was his ability to pull off comedy. Because Young and Innocent is absolutely one of the funniest, sweetest films I have ever seen. And I purely loved it. It's one of those movies that you just have to purely love. I mean, not just because of Hitchcock, but because of the fact that he's dealing with a subject matter that is quite gruesome at times, but at the same time, in dealing with that subject matter, he brings an innocent nature to it, and he brings an honest nature to it that at times can comment on human society as being quite funny. So those are my confessions, sir. Those of what I've seen in the past week or so.
Good for you.
I've seen more, but I still need to do. Those were the two that kind of stuck out. More of After School, because I hated it so much in the last 45 seconds. And the second one being that it was Alfred Hitchcock, and I had to talk about some of his early. Alright, so what we're going to be moving on right now to is our top five.
Should we start with the honorable mentions?
Yeah, we'll start with the honorable mentions. This is our top five. Okay, so every week we're going to be doing a top five in cinema. This week what we're doing is a top five loners. Alright, sir, so let us start with you, Mr. Nelson. What is your honorable mention? We're going to start with that. What is your first honorable mention?
Logan.
Okay.
From the X-Men series.
Okay.
If you're familiar with the comics, you know Logan. You know Wolverine.
Yes.
I don't really have to say more than that. He is loner personified.
Okay.
In the movie series, you see him grow from a loner into a leader.
Okay.
Now, granted, Final Stand is probably Brett Ratner's worst film.
Yes.
And yet, it stands as one, as a surprisingly enjoyable little popcorn flick.
As some people say, I will say it, I was so, my expectations were so low going into this film that I actually enjoyed it.
They do stay surprisingly true to the Logan character, which I think has more to do with Hugh Jackman playing the role than anything else. He really dug his teeth into the part, and you can see that in even X-Men Origins Wolverine. He knows this character inside and out. He knows how to play him. But, like I said, you see, if you follow the chronology of the movies, X-Men Origins takes place first. X-Men, X2, X-Men Final Stand. At that point, Logan is pretty much running the show.
Agreed.
Has as much to do with the studio recognizing they had a bankable star in Hugh Jackman as anything else. But it fits, and it also follows the comics almost to the T in the fact that Wolverine is almost the de facto leader of the X-Men.
It follows it in that certain degree. X-Men Last Stand, I will say, does not take the Phoenix Saga and use it to that degree that it was
And the only person to ever do that right was Chris Claremont.
Okay.
In the comic book series. I'll give the animated series its props because they did a damn fine job of handling it.
Yes, they did.
But even,
as I remember, they stretched it out almost an entire season.
Yes, but even then, in the animated series, Wolverine was often relegated to a side role. He had his... They tended to focus on one mutant or another in each episode, and Wolverine had his fair share, but they never got the cohesiveness of the group right, in my opinion. That was the only drawback to the animated series, but Logan is your quintessential loner who grows into a leadership role, mostly because he's forced into it. There's no one else.
This is your honorable mention. I agree. I think it's a good honorable mention. My first honorable mention would be Robert Mitchum from Cape Fear. You have the quintessential loner bad guy. He's evil. He's pure evil, and oftentimes with this evil comes a loner mentality. He's either been put aside in society because of his behavior, or from the time he's young, he's put aside in society as a stigma in society because of a status that his mother may have had. We never get to know this, but that's not the point. The point is that he acts outside of the realms of natural society. He acts outside of the things that are needed of society to become a lawful, abiding citizen. And he becomes the quintessential loner who has one mission in his life, and that is to torture the attorney that was responsible for his jail sentence. He has no friends. He has no family. He has one mission, and he is not going to rely on anybody to help him out with that mission. That's why I classify him, and that will go for my honorable mention.
What's your next one, sir? Also from the X-Men series. Magneto.
Agreed. Good one.
And the reason I'm putting these as honorable mentions is solely because in a lot of ways they're too pop culture-y.
Yes.
Although most of my top five are pop culture.
Okay.
But Magneto represents the other side of the spectrum. Wolverine becomes the leader, not by choice, but because it's forced upon him. There's no one else to take that role.
Okay.
Magneto is the loner that needs to surround himself with people in order to, with other people in order to feel powerful.
Okay.
Beyond that, he has a mission which puts him, he has a personal mission, a personal vendetta that puts him outside the norms of society.
Yes, I agree with you, sir.
He has intentionally ostracized himself from the rest of the world.
Because he hates the rest of the world. He hates what they've done to the X-Men. To mutants, not the X-Men.
He views it from the light of his own personal experience. The movies actually do accurately represent that. Even X-Men Final Stand, which we've both agreed is the weakest in the entire series.
But I will have to say this, Michael Fassbender as Magneto in X-Men First Class is the best performance.
I argue Ian McKellen in X2.
He's good. But Michael Fassbender is able to capture that hate, that anger, and that pure intention of destruction.
But you see in Ian McKellen the weariness that hate has brought upon him.
Good point.
You see a man, Fassbender's Magneto is willing to go to any lengths because it's the only way he knows. It's the only way he understands.
But you see what that's done over time with McKellen's.
McKellen's performance is no less as ruthless as Fassbender's.
Agreed.
But he's doing it not out of a need, not out of this stubborn desire for vengeance, whether it's against the people that slaughtered his kind as a German Jew in World War II, but against mutant kind as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
McKellen's Magneto is lashing out at humanity as a whole, not just mutants. Not just humans, but mutants as well. He's willing to sacrifice anyone. In Fassbender's version, would not sacrifice a mutant.
No.
As long as they stood with him.
Good choice.
McKellen's version would sacrifice anyone. He sacrifices Mystique.
Mm-hmm.
When she ultimately shows to not be useful to him.
You know what, sir? I think you have a good choice there. I agree with it. My number two honorable mention is Mr. Kevin Spacey from Seven. That is a loner. So much so that Fincher never gives you his real name.
John Doe.
That's all it is. He's completely withdrawn from society.
Well, he's a sociopath, so.
He is, but he's also obsessed with observing the people around him. And oftentimes what you'll see with loners are people who don't interact, but they observe. And he does observe. He observes the sins of humanity and decides that he is going to punish those who break the seven deadly sins, commit the seven deadly sins. That is his option. That is his choice. But what would have been different with Kevin Spacey's character had he connected with him, with somebody, anybody, on a human level? Because he didn't.
No, that's the difference. That's our difference in opinion, then. Because I argue he did make a personal connection with Brad Pitt's character.
See, I argue that he was not ever trying to make a personal connection.
It wasn't his choice that it happened. But the final scene where he's discussing the wife, you realize this guy does have some humanity in him. But then he takes that humanity and he shreds it.
But you also remember and realize that he is is the true definition of a loner. Because that is per that conversation with Brad Pitt at the end of the movie. He believes he is better than the rest. Not only has he been able to punish those who've committed the seven deadly sins, or one of the seven deadly sins, but he is also able to choose his own death, knowing what would happen. He's extremely intelligent, but as a loner definition goes, he often puts himself above the rest of humanity. He is more intelligent, quote-unquote, than anybody else in this world.
Fair enough.
He sees the bigger picture. He realizes that life, government, taxes, society, at the end of the day, doesn't mean a hell of a lot of difference. So for me, he was one of those ultimate loners who not only punished individuals, but at the same time proved to be a teacher of sorts. And you know what? You can almost see a direct reference in the Saw movies from the John Doe character. Don't get me wrong. First Saw, second Saw, third Saw, I liked. Rest of them, I just kept watching to figure out what was going on. I didn't really care past a certain point. Okay, what's your next honorable mention?
Alright, and this is my last one as far as honorable mentions go.
Okay.
It's also my least pop culture reference, and if you think about it, it's in some ways the ultimate pop culture reference.
Okay.
Hamlet.
Alright, okay, I'm listening.
Each of my honorable mentions represents a different type of loner. Logan is the one who starts out putting himself apart from society until society forces him back in.
Okay.
Magneto was the one who willingly separates himself from society, yet surrounds himself with it.
Okay.
Hamlet purposely withdraws from society and never fully reintegrates.
No, he doesn't.
He spurns every chance that Shakespeare gives him, and I've read the play. I've seen several different incarnations. My personal favorite is the Mel Gibson film version, which is...
That's what I was fixing to ask you.
...is probably the one that I'm basing this most off of, just for memory purposes.
I also... A lot of people give me crap for this, but I actually enjoyed the modern-day revision of Hamlet starring Mr. Ethan Hawke.
Is that the Kenneth Branagh one?
Yes. With
Robin Williams and Billy Crystal?
No.
Okay.
But I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, Branagh made a modern-day version as well.
Yeah, but Hamlet was relatively good.
But,
it's my favorite Shakespeare.
But...
Besides The Tempest.
Yeah. I haven't read The Tempest. I know the story, but I'm not familiar with it.
Anyway, so...
But Hamlet is the one who completely refuses society at every turn.
Mm-hmm.
And he pays the ultimate sacrifice for it. He refuses society, society refuses him, he dies at the end of the play.
Mm-hmm.
If he'd accepted Ophelia's love, he still could have gotten his revenge and had a happy ending.
He's willing to take death.
If he had... managed to avoid killing Polonius, who knows what would have happened.
True.
If he had accepted the friendship of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, he might have been able to sway them from taking him to his death rather than pitting them to the same fate that he had, that they were taking him to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the play flat out states Rosencrantz and Guildenstern were old school school child friends.
Mm-hmm.
of Hamlet's.
I agree.
He knew these guys. And yet, he ultimately spurns their affection, Ophelia's affection, which is one of the sweetest and purest examples of love I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
As far as chaste love goes. He even spurns his own mother's affections. Granted, her mother is being bent by the manipulations of Claudius, but if he had at least talked about what was going on to his mother, I mean, things could have turned differently.
He could have, but
he was so bent on revenge.
Just like Kevin Spacey in Seven. It's bent on that one focus. Purely defines a loner. Good choice, sir. Absolutely. Alright. So my last honorable mention. It's a little bit of a cheat. But I hope you're ready for this. It's not necessarily a movie, but it is an actor. And I'm going to say it's probably within the recent 7 to 8 years. And that is Mr. Nicolas Cage in Hollywood. He is a loner in Hollywood. He is a guy who will take any type of project that you throw at him. And don't get me wrong, this is not calling Nicolas Cage out on something. Because to be honest with you, I loved Ghost Rider.
I didn't, but I didn't hate it either, so.
I loved Drive Angry. Pure exploitation cinema. That's all it was. Mm-hmm. It was stupid. If you're going into a Nicolas Cage movie today, expecting something of value or of artistic quality, such as Bringing Out the Dead, which Scorsese directed.
Adaptation,
that's a classic. Or, even if you're going to go all the way to Leaving Las Vegas. You know, I mean, Nicolas Cage these days has really become a character of himself.
Fair enough.
So I depict him as a loner from Hollywood in general, as he will do anything, including the terrible Season of the Witch.
I actually have that queued on Netflix to watch.
That's where I watched it. Alright. So now we get into our top 5 loner films. Those were our honorable mentions. Some of these films you can check out on instant streaming on Netflix. Some of these films you will just have to go find yourself. But we will start with Bill's number 5.
Okay. This one may be somewhat obscure. It's from a very, very, very famous sci-fi novel. There have so far been 2 attempts to bring it to film. The TV miniseries version is the better version. Truer to the book.
I think I know where you're going with this.
But there's something to be said for what David Lynch's version from, I can't remember if it was 83 or 84, I think it was 84, tried to do. And this would be from the movie Dune. The character, Paul Muad'Dib, also known as Paul Atreides. And he is the first and probably only loner on my list.
Okay.
That is not a loner by choice.
Okay.
He is a loner because of his own natural abilities.
All right. I think that's a good choice.
Paul Atreides was, within the series of novels that the Dune series is gifted with what's known as prescience, what we might call ESP.
Okay, so do they reflect this in the Lynch film?
Yes.
All right.
Not as well as could be expected, but it's very strongly hinted at. The powers of... He is called the Kwisatz Haderach.
Okay, so let me ask you a question. What makes him an appealing loner character?
Paul Muad'Dib is this man who is surrounded by people who are willing to follow him to the death. And he anguishes over the fact that he's going to order them basically to their deaths in a jihad, in a war, that he knows he has no chance of winning because he can see the future. His every step is to try to avoid that future, and yet every step he takes he knows is going to bring him closer to that future. Mm-hmm. He's caught in a trap. And his only defense is to separate himself.
Okay.
He's neither seeking leadership or seeking the adoration of others without actually accepting the humanity that they offer him. He is literally put in a role where he has no way to connect with other people. The closest he comes is with his true wife, because he is legally married to another woman, although it's a sham marriage. If you follow the books, seen any of the movies, you understand this. I won't go into details on that because it would take too long to explain. But his wife, Chaney, she is the closest to understanding who and what Muad'Dib really is.
Okay.
And even she can't fathom what he sees.
Okay.
So for me, that's why he is a loner. There is literally no way for him to connect with society.
I like it. Okay. My number five. Mr. Rupert Pumpkin. Pumpkin. Sorry, I'll have to pronounce it right. Played by Robert De Niro in Scorsese's picture, The King of Comedy.
Okay.
Which is, by far, one of the most disturbing films I've ever seen. So you may be asking yourself why Rupert Pumpkin is such a great loner character. Well, in this movie you have a man who is completely obsessed with fame. He's completely obsessed with being in the public eye because he is not himself a popular individual. Well, what occurs is throughout the course of the movie, Rupert Pumpkin, actually ends up becoming obsessed with becoming a comedian. So, Jerry Lewis plays a late night host who hosts a TV show. And what occurs is that Robert De Niro's character, Rupert, kidnaps Jerry Lewis and forces him to record Robert De Niro doing stand-up comedy. He is a man who is completely absorbed into one mission, into one goal. He never wants to become a friend. He never wants to become an enemy. He just wants to become famous. And then throughout the course of the movie, he actually becomes infamous for what he does. So Robert De Niro's character is, to me, he's the pure definition of a loner, and he's one of the funnest loners to actually watch on screen, because not just how crazy he is, but because of his inability to connect with humanity, except through the process of making people laugh, which is bizarre and outrageous when you think he is trying to connect through comedy. And the only way he can do it is to kidnap a late night host and make him record his television program. Alright, sir, moving on to your number four.
My number four is actually a tie, both from the same flick.
And your number four is, sir?
It is, like you said, a tie. Billy Costigan and Colin Sullivan from The Departed.
Nice. I can deal with that.
The Departed is such a brilliant film to start with.
Yes. Absolutely agree. It's, as we've talked about, my very favorite Scorsese movie.
Yes, mine as well. But ultimately, it's the pairing of these two different men.
Okay.
One who knows he's a loner and is essentially a loner by choice, although he hates the situation that he's forced, that he feels like he's been forced into. He's an undercover cop, so deep undercover that there's really no one he can talk to. He lies to everyone he knows about who he really is, and is just completely isolated. And that's obviously Leonardo DiCaprio's character, Billy Costigan.
True.
Matt Damon's character is the loner that doesn't realize he's a loner.
True.
He thinks he's surrounded himself by people and deluded himself into believing that because he has achieved a level of importance, because he's achieved some level of greatness, that all these people that are around him like him.
Okay.
Really, they're either sycophants or people that are just attracted to the power in the first place.
Okay.
The closest thing he has to a meaningful relationship is with Vera Farmiga's character, and
even that's not...
It's based solely on his belief that that she's he's basically mistaking attraction for love.
Sure, absolutely. I absolutely agree with you.
She actually, to a certain extent, does fall in love with him until she starts to get an idea of who he really is.
Through the other loner's eyes, a Mr. Leonardo DiCaprio.
But the only reason he's with her is because he thinks that's what he's supposed to do.
Yeah.
So, he is the self-deluded loner.
Yeah.
But it's the pairing of those two and the way they offset each other, the way they're almost really the same person. Mm-hmm. Just with different results, just with different choices that they've made in life, they've ended up in different places.
True. Very true. That is a very good argument for those two loner characters. Especially two loners who, in the middle of a situation, can be surrounded by people, but have nobody that they can trust. And it's not just due to their job. It's mostly due to their job, but it's also a lot to do with their nature and how they grew up.
Mm-hmm. Very good choice, sir.
I can see that, absolutely. The Departed, if you've never seen it, it's been out since 2008. I and Bill will suggest that you need to see The Departed, which is also a remake of an Asian film, which is...
That's a trilogy.
Eternal Affairs, and I've seen the first one. I haven't watched the rest. It's a very good film, but Scorsese's use of Boston and the accent and the way people talk and the intent down there as far as the mindset of not just criminals but cops in that area. I found it very interesting. In fact, for the longest time after I watched The Departed, I wanted to move to Boston. Okay, good choice. All right, my number four is The Lieutenant from Bad Lieutenant. Harvey Keitel. This is not a likable person. Is he a loner? Absolutely. Is he completely isolated? Absolutely. What isolates him? What makes him a loner? It's his addictions. It's all of his addictions. His addiction to gambling, his drug addiction, and he's the ultimate loner because he's looking for some type of redemption throughout the story, even though we as the audience know that he is just a despicable, despicable character. The whole time you're watching it, you're going, someone just needs to kill him. Someone just needs to off him. He has separated himself from his family by staying out to ungodly hours. He does cocaine. He kills for money. And he's a lieutenant on the police force. He pulls people over, young women, and he proceeds to sexually assault these young women. And what causes in the course of the movie is him to look for redemption is a nun is raped, and he is going to go after the perp. And he's looking for redemption through God's eyes, thinking that if I say one of God's chosen few, then maybe God will let me into his heaven. Maybe God will forgive me for the things and the sins that I've done. And to me, he's such an interesting character portrayal because he is just so terrible as a person. And so terrible as a cop. And he treats everybody around him like crap. And you can really see at that point where addiction is the one thing that's really separating him from the rest of the world. He has no friends. He has several enemies. And a lot of the movie, he is sitting, he is not even seen with any other characters. He's seen a lot by himself, either driving in his car, praying, or listening to, I believe it was the Dodgers game, of which he has a bet on at that time. It's a great, great piece of cinema. I will warn you, it is in NC-17. It's extremely hard to watch, but Harvey Keitel is a tour de force to be reckoned with. Quick note, too, for that, they made a unrelated feature film back in 2007 called Bad Lieutenant, Protocol New Orleans, starring Nicolas Cage. It is also a great movie. Now, they share a lot of similar events to them, but Werner Herzog directed Bad Lieutenant, Protocol New Orleans, and he's even come out and stated, these have nothing to do with each other, I've never even heard of the first movie. But they're a great pairing, especially for a double feature night. Especially if you really want to push somebody as far as their cinema watching goes. Have them watch these too, because these are art house slash grindhouse films at their very worst, which is their very best. Alright, you're number three, sir.
Oh, my number three.
Okay.
Is Andy Stitzer.
Okay.
Steve Carell's character from The 40-Year-Old Virgin.
Okay, okay. Let's hear it.
He is the nerdy loner.
Yes, true. Collects action figures.
Collects action figures.
Is a virgin at 40.
There's really not much else to say there. I mean, he's just, he has had in his prime, in his earlier years, he had so many bad experiences with women that he just shut himself off from society.
True.
And that's really all there is to it. It takes
a broken-hearted loner.
It takes the playful mockery and eventual friendship of several co-workers to even bring him out of his shell.
Yes, that's true. And at the end of the movie, he does find what he is looking for.
And ends it on a joyful musical note with Asia.
Yes, that's true. still a great movie. Arguably the best, the first outing into cinema from Judd Apatow, but arguably the best outing into cinema from Judd Apatow, although I'm a personal fan of Funny People.
I personally prefer Knocked Up myself, but there aren't really any loners in that movie, so...
No, no.
Okay.
My number three is Zatoichi, the Blind Swordsman. Now, I would give you an actor's name, but there's been multiple actors that have portrayed Zatoichi. They've even made a 2003 Zatoichi movie that has a female protagonist in it. All excellent. Zatoichi is the Japanese representation of a mystical character in human form. I mean, how much more of a loner can you get in feudal Japan than a blind guy? I mean, you have a man with a great disability. He spends a lot of time alone. Now, throughout the movies, he often goes out on adventures, and usually what the movies happen, with what actually occurs in the films, is these are adventures that are not by his own will. They are seemingly he just in the wrong place at the wrong time, and he's always proving his skill set by attacking anybody who is an antagonist to the storyline itself. And he's excellent. He's an excellent swordsman. He's blind, and he's lived for 38 films or some odd thing like that. I mean, he's very, very good. But the one thing about this character that really makes him that loner is that he purposely, in the movies, he always starts alone, and he always ends the movies alone. He doesn't end the movie with anybody else. He's always reflecting. He's always praying. So the one thing about this character is he's that loner out of spiritual necessity. He's always trying to find that spiritual guidance. And it's a very interesting portrayal of an action hero to not only be blind, but to also be spiritually based, too. Now, it is the Japanese faith, so it has no... It's not a Christian spirituality I'm talking about. Which is one thing I do like about the Japanese, though, is that samurai, you know, these movies that they make about feudal Japan, about samurai, a lot of the times you'll find their own spiritual beliefs based in these films. And, you know, not just their spiritual, but, you know, their beliefs about nature, their beliefs about creation, you'll find these things. And that's something I very much enjoy. And Zatoichi, to me, is the action hero loner who is such an inspiration for all types of other heroes, because he's funny, but at the end of the day, the only one he connects with is himself. He has no real human connection with anybody else. And they actually remade this into a 1989 film starring Rutger Hauer called Blind Fury, which was an interesting film. Your number two.
My number two actually somewhat goes with your number three.
Okay.
My number two is, and this is from a very specific era of this character, because the character spans over 40 years of cinema, but James Bond.
Okay.
And specifically the Daniel Craig era.
Okay, yeah.
Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace. When James Bond first started, he was portrayed as a very playful cad who happens to be extremely good at what he does.
Yes.
It wasn't until the Daniel Craig Bonds, and I'll agree with everyone else, Quantum of Solace was not what Casino Royale was. I find it to be a very highly enjoyable film.
I still haven't seen it.
But it doesn't have the power and the force and the villain himself. The actual villain of the film, because there's two villains within the Daniel Craig versions.
Okay.
There's the organization that's controlling all of the villains, which we learn in Quantum of Solace is named Quantum.
Okay.
And then there is the specific villain for the film.
Okay.
In Casino Royale, it was Mads Mikkelsen. I forget the actor's name that played him in Quantum of Solace, but the Quantum of Solace villain does descend into this somewhat into the James Bond villain archetype.
Okay.
Not as overly so as was done by, like, Goldfinger. It was just pure camp.
Okay.
But it's this progression of Bond. Because, as I said, he was portrayed as this lovable cad who just happens to be damn good at what he does.
True.
In the beginning. The Daniel Craig Bonds are the first ones to, as far as the character goes, get really close to portraying him as Ian Fleming wrote him. Which is, he's ruthless. He doesn't make friends easily. He tends to put people off, keep people at a distance, even when he's somewhat happy. Which, most of Casino Royale, he's somewhat happy.
True.
It's not until he feels that he's been betrayed by Vesper Lynd that he basically swears off human contact. The only person that can get reasonably close to him is Judi Dench's M, and that's only because they have a mutual respect for each other, even if she doesn't always agree with his methods.
Okay.
Of course, there's also Felix Leiter, but Leiter, in this version of Bond, is hampered by the bureaucracies of the CIA and has yet to fully prove himself the one true friend that the James Bond novels, Ian Fleming's novels, portray him to be.
Okay.
So basically, you've got this guy who feels that he's been spurned by love, spurned by the world, and to a certain extent is taking his vengeance out on it. I mean, that's pretty much all Casino Royale is.
Yeah.
Or not Casino Royale, Quantum of Solace. It's him lashing out at the people that he feels is responsible for destroying his view of the world.
Interesting choice, but I like it. And I can see it. I mean, you have no real significant connections there. No real significant friendships.
Well, see, that's the thing. The movies, James Bond actually has a very detailed backstory.
Okay.
And the movies themselves have never gotten into it. He was basically raised to be a spy. He was orphaned at a very young age. His parents died in a mountain climbing accident. And at a very young age, they were wealthy. He's actually, if you follow the novels, he's actually part of the British aristocracy. He has a title.
Interesting.
I believe he was basically born as a knight. Essentially born into knighthood.
So he does have that background.
So he was born into money. His parents died. He inherited their wealth, but because he didn't have any legal guardians, he was raised by the state. And at a very young age, they identified factors in him, qualities within him, that would make him a good spy. And rather than giving him a choice in life, he was raised with the grooming to become that man. And so I'm interested to see if they actually bring that into the story. They have yet to state if Daniel Craig is going to continue with Bond after this next movie, Skyfall.
I thought they said that he was. Maybe not.
I haven't heard. I would like to see him continue because next to Connery, Craig is the best. Pierce Brosnan is a very close third.
I do like Pierce Brosnan.
Followed by Roger Moore. I take that back. Roger Moore, and I always forget his name, but the guy that played Bond in Honor Majesty's Secret Service
okay.
are very close together. It could flip-flop. Probably Moore gets the fourth spot just because he did more. But Timothy Dalton is a very distant dead last.
Yes.
Which is sad because The Living Daylights was such an excellent film. But
George Lansby. Honor Majesty's
Thank
Secret
you.
Service.
Yes. Lazenby.
Lazenby. But, by the way, people, you will know that I'm very bad at name pronunciation sometimes. Telly Savalas was in that one.
Interesting. Which one? Oh, yes.
Her
yes.
Majesty's Secret Service. That's a guy I always liked.
He played Blofeld. He was one of the many actors to play Blofeld.
He is such a good actor. I mean, Telly Savalas, just as a quick cutaway, come on, Kojak. Awesome.
Yeah.
Just awesome. Suck
his lollipops.
Yes, he did, sir. Yes, he did. And he was in the Muppet movie. His character name was El Sleazo Tough. Love it. All right, so where were we?
Just finished my number two. What's yours?
Oh, my number two. And my number two is Rick. Humphrey Bogart's character from Casablanca.
Okay.
Some would argue, no, that he's not a loner. Because he wants to go after the girl, he's got the friendship with the policeman, but you have to understand the events in the movie is what causes him to have that friendship at the end of the movie. These are the events. This man is to me, the loner portrayed via breaking of his heart. Because he goes to Paris, he falls in love, turns around, she breaks his heart because the Germans are infiltrating, and she's also married, which she does not tell him. And what does he do? What does he do when Bergman breaks his heart? He runs off to Africa. And he opens up a bar. Tell me that that's not a loner status there. He's got friends, quote unquote, but these are not real friends. He keeps himself very much a distance from everybody. The piano player himself, played by the late, very amazing Dooley Wilson within cinema history, died too young. But he sits there and he separates himself from society. He's so brokenhearted that he just wants to be alone. And yet, at the same time, he feels like he may lose his mind from his heartbreak by being alone. So what does he do? He opens up a bar and surrounds himself with people who just want his attention. They just want money. They want to gamble. They want to drink. They want favors. But they just don't want him. The only one who wanted him was the girl. And at the end of the movie, you do get to that point, though, where he does make his friendship. Chief, and you know, that's a great transformation piece, but that comes from Rick finally being able to let go his broken heart. He lets Bergman get on the plane, he lets her go, and the reason he does is because he thinks it's the correct choice. I mean, Claude Rains as Captain Louis Renault plays his friend, but once he's able to let Bergman go and literally, not literally and metaphorically, let her go by letting her get on that plane. Is he able to finally move past that lonership? He's able to move into a state of acceptance and finally being able to get rid of it. But he's a loner at the beginning of the movie, and he walks away from the movie a complete changed man. But I think he's an excellent loner character, because what other loner do you have in cinema history that gets his heart broken and then moves to Africa to open up a bar? To me, amazing. Wouldn't have it any other way. Casablanca is, as me and you have often talked about, my number one film of all time. Casablanca,
yep.
Greatest film ever made. I will never back down from that. I don't care how many great movies I've seen. Casablanca, awesome.
Number two. Keep in mind, folks, he still hasn't seen Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow.
Oh, yeah. That may not happen. But it's kind of sad because this is just a testament to the very bizarre nature I have with cinema as far as loving both grindhouse and classic. My number one is Casablanca. My number two is the 80s masterpiece, and I argue this, The Monster Squad. Oh, I love The Monster Squad.
Decker did not get enough chances to do movies after RoboCop 3, of course.
Well, there's a good reason, and that's RoboCop 3.
I don't care. The Monster Squad and Night of the Creeps speak to themselves.
It's amazing they let Frank Miller keep writing movies after RoboCop 3.
Well, you know, it happens. All right, what's your number two, sir?
That's my number one.
Oh, yes, I forgot. My countdown was off.
Oh. I still have some issues with this choice. Not so much that he doesn't deserve to be on the list, but I couldn't think of a better number one, but I'm not happy with him as my number one.
Okay.
And this is Aragorn from The Lord of the Rings.
Okay.
And this is as much a testament, more a testament to Peter Jackson's vision than anything else, in that he perfectly captures Aragorn's story arc from the book. The books themselves really don't give that much detail on Aragorn's history.
Okay.
Aragorn is pretty much shrouded in mystery the entire series. Because, I mean, once you get past the first book, it's about the journey.
Okay.
And the dual journeys that Frodo and Sam are taking, pitted against the journey that the rest of the remaining fellowship is taking. And so you start to lose that single character story arc building that the first third to half of the first book, the Fellowship of the Ring, really has.
Mm-hmm.
But Peter Jackson takes the bits and scraps and hints that Tolkien puts throughout each novel and gives you a very complete history. And he uses other source materials too. Aragorn is briefly mentioned in several of Tolkien's novels. So there's other hints about his history. And he builds this and deepens the character of Arwen to the point that you actually understand this man. You know the pain that he's going through. He knows he's destined to be king. He doesn't want the mantle of leadership. He shunned away from it in the very beginning and joined with the Rangers.
So you're saying he's the opposite of Simba from The Lion King. Simba when he was a young age said, "I just can't wait to be king."
I really wouldn't compare the two, seeing as how
it's a joke.
This.
Anyway, keep going, sir.
That's my issue is, ultimately, he's, as a character, just too similar to most of the other characters that I've shown, I've listed. So it's really more a testament to Peter Jackson capturing what was on paper and translating it so perfectly in the film than the specific value of the character himself.
I can see. Okay. I like your choices, though. So, my number one. From a little movie. Came out 2009.
Little Shop of Horrors?
No, it didn't come out in 2009, sir.
It should have
always come out. I think they should re-release it every year. Hey, Rick Moranis, love it. The musical, awesome.
There's also the Corman version with Jack Nicholson.
True. Okay, my number one comes from 2009, directed by the great Andrea Arnold. It's a little movie called Fish Tank, and it
it's a British film. The character that I'm more referring to is Katie Jarvis's Mia, who is the protagonist of the film. Here's a woman who is isolated from her mother. She's isolated from society. She's very angry all the time. She's constantly attacking anybody who would be approaching her. She's constantly pushing people away. She has a terrible relationship with her mother. She's always calling her mother several profane words. And at the end of the day, all she's really wanting is for someone to not just respect her, but to also show her that she's validated in life. She's lost. Mm-hmm. She's got nobody. And then along comes her mother's new boyfriend, played by Michael Fassbender, who she's seeing this validation from him because he's validating what she says. He's validating the things she says. And she's okay with that. Then the obsession goes a little too far. And she starts to want her mother's boyfriend for herself. Well, the issue is that she's 15 years old at the moment. They do show... Now, the actress at the time was 18 years old. But she does end up isolating herself even further by having sex with her mother's boyfriend while he was drunk one night. And the whole time, the only dream she wants is to be able to dance. This is how it leads to this, is because she dances for him. Follows him home because he gets up and leaves the next day. And all she wants is just to be validated by somebody, by anybody. And here's the one opportunity for her to be validated. And she does not realize, being the young 15-year-old that she is, that this is a man. He wanted sex. He was drunk. After it was done, he doesn't want anything else to do with you. She follows him home. Turns out that Michael Fassbender is married. And then you have preceding the most disturbing cinema I've seen in a long time for about 20 minutes. Nothing really ever happens. But what does occur is Mia waits till they leave. She breaks into the house. She pees on his carpet. She's pissed. She's angry. But then she finds out he has a little girl. She takes the little girl forcefully. Once she takes the little girl, spoiler alert, should have probably gone out on that one, but okay. Once she takes the little girl by the hand, she starts to lead her away. She doesn't really know where she's going. As you can see, she's just trying to strike out in any way she possibly can. She eventually throws the little girl into the river, then rescues her all over again, returns the little girl to her home, and the whole time she just ends up back where she started, just wishing to be validated. She doesn't connect with her mother. She doesn't connect with her sister. She doesn't connect with even the boy she's supposed to be having a relationship with. She really does have this one dream to be a dancer, and that is it. And to me, she's just this very sad, heartbreaking character, who at the same time is so well portrayed that, I mean, it's a beautiful character study. As it says, fish tent. She feels isolated. And that's what you're looking for. We appreciate you sticking with us through our recording of our first podcast. We're going to continue to tweak and alter what we do. This one was a little bit more off the cuff. In the future, I believe what we'll be doing is more preparation. But I thought it was good, sir.
It was fun.
Yes, it was. So I will leave the viewer or the listener with one last thought. Screw what the critics say. Make up your own.
Good advice.
Well, we will hear from you. We will talk to you next week. And until then, keep loving what you do. Keep watching.
And to quote one of my all-time favorite movies, in case I don't see you, good afternoon, good evening, and good night.